and welcome to South Sudan in Focus on The Voice of America. I'm your host, John Tanza, coming to you live from Washington. Here are some of the top stories making news across South Sudan, Sudan, and the rest of Africa this Wednesday, November 27, 2024. South Sudan's ambassador to the United States says he was attacked by his colleague at the South Sudan Embassy in Washington. And leaders of the South Sudan Patriotic Movement disagree over party rules.
He has built up a parallel party, not the party which I know. He has his own second party, which he calls SSPM, and appointed the people there to be members of the parliament. As I told you from the beginning, I said that I don't know many people, so I allowed him to appoint the ministers and the members of parliament.
We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. A member of the South Sudan's umbrella political group, the South Sudan Opposition Alliance, is going through a power struggle. The chairperson of the South Sudan Patriotic Movement, Castelo Garang, and his deputy, Hussein Abdul Baghi, are struggling to maintain their positions amid intra-party power struggle. Castelo Garang, who heads the South Sudan Patriotic Movement, says Hussein Abdul Baghi, South Sudan's vice president, is not the leader of the South Sudan Patriotic Movement.
When decision was taken that there were going to be five vice presidents, that there were already three in Upper Nile. This is the Rebecca Domabior, Ariag Machar, and Taban Deng. And then in Equatoria, we have already James Waniga. So they said the next vice president was going to go to Barack Lazan. And that became, was supposed to be me, in fact. But I got sick. I was very sick in Germany. And nobody even knew that I was going to survive that, you know. So when I was asked by my group, yeah, whether they should put my name on the ticket to run for the vice presidency, I told them, no, first of all, I was not in the talks. And my duty was I asked my deputy to represent me in the talks, Hussein Abdul Baghi. So I told Hussein, you go to Addis Ababa and go and represent me there. When the position of the vice president came up, I told him to take it. If it falls to us, I told him, you take that position. And then when I came to Juba 2020, people were talking about appointing the parliaments in the state parliaments and positions in the parliament. I told him I have been away for 50 years, so I know really nobody. The people I know are the people who were with us in the struggle, people like President Salva Kiir and Nyal Deng Nyal and Dr. John Garang and so on. These are the people whom I was dealing with as their ambassador, as their diplomat. Hussein, by then, was with Bashir, you know. He was in the Islamic movement in Khartoum. He was with the PDF. So we had, in fact, nothing in common, yeah. But later on, of course, after reconciliation and so on, we said that, okay, we could work together. And I am blood related to him. I'm blood related to him, his mother. His grandmother, the mother of his mother, is my father's sister. My father is Paramount Chief Renewal of Ayat in northern Barack Lazan.
So this South Sudan Patriotic Movement is run by cousins?
Well, it happened by accident, of course, because, you know, when you rebel, you take whoever comes to you, you don't wait for the best people you want, you know? So who were there, one of the first people who were there was Hussein. And among those who were there, I thought that he was the one who was more politicized and who understands a lot about politics, which turned out later on not to be true, of course, because he has been all over the Islamic movement for a very long time. So now, when I came back now, when I became well and I came back, I didn't come and stay for 1 month as I used to do, things became very difficult for him because he thought that I was going for his position. Well, you see, I cannot say how it is going to end, but what I can tell you is this. As the chairman of the SSPM, I have been here in Juba for the last 7 months, and he started organizing his convention without even me being informed. I didn't know that there was a convention taking place. He did it secretly. He has built up a parallel party, not the party which I know. He has his own second party, which he calls SSPM, and appointed the people there to be members of the parliament. As I told you from the beginning, I said that I don't know many people, so I allowed him to appoint the ministers and the members of parliament. He went and appointed the people who became loyal to him personally, no longer loyal to the party. And these are the people he collected and made a convention at his home, was not even outside his place, and then brought in even his brothers who are officers in the army, whom we have already integrated into the army, and some of them we are going to integrate it, we are going to integrate in the army. It is not allowed to bring soldiers, you see, into political rallies, you know.
According to SOA, who is now the legitimate representative or the legitimate leader of the South Sudan Patriotic Movement?
SOA wrote to the president saying that I am the legitimate leader. It is signed by SOA leaders, and it has been handed to the office of the president. So for SOA, I am the legitimate representative. He was ignoring SOA anyway, and I have been telling him in good faith there is no way you could keep the position of vice president without having to go through SOA, because he needs SOA votes, you know. And I told him from the beginning, I was not interested in being vice president. Of course, it is very unusual in South Sudan that somebody tells somebody to become vice president. I don't want the position, you know. So I left it to him for 4 years, and I allowed him to do whatever he wants. Then the whole thing turned out to be a semi-Islamic group, because he's using methods which are not used by somebody who wants democracy.
In the name of fairness, Hussein Abdul Baghi is not here to defend himself. When you're saying he's using undemocratic principles to conduct business within the South Sudan Patriotic Front, are you using democratic principles?
No, within SOA even, within SOA, not only within Southern Sudan Patriotic Front, but also in SOA. You can ask all the SOA leaders.
Are you using democratic principles within the South Sudan Patriotic Movement as far as your decisions are concerned?
No, well, as I told you that I was sick and I was supposed to die, in fact. Nobody was expecting me to survive, including him. But when I came back, I found him quarreling with SOA, not with me. The fight was between him and the leaders of SOA, who were complaining that he has taken over SOA and was behaving alone. He doesn't consult them. The meeting we was done 2 weeks ago with the president was the first meeting of the SOA leaders with the president since the government was formed 2020.
For the benefit of our listeners, how is this stalemate going to be resolved? Because he has fired you from the chairmanship, you have fired him from the deputy chairmanship of your party.
Vice chairman in a political party, in a democratic political party, don't call secret conventions and then dismiss the chairman without him being even informed to attend, you know? So that itself shows that he is undemocratic. The second thing is, as I told you before, the leaders of SOA have written to the president. They have written to the president and they have signed and they have said that they don't want his end.
That's Castelo Garang, leader of the South Sudan Patriotic Movement. He spoke to me via WhatsApp from Juba earlier today. South Sudan's ambassador to the United States, Santino Fardol, says he was allegedly attacked by his colleague at the South Sudan's embassy in Washington, D.C. South Sudan in Focus obtained a letter addressed to the undersecretary in South Sudan's Ministry of Foreign Affairs calling for intervention. Ambassador Fardol's letter urged the government of South Sudan to take action against his colleague who assaulted him. South Sudan in Focus will update you on the conflict at the South Sudan embassy here in Washington. This program called South Sudan's Deputy Foreign Minister, Mande Sumeya, for comments, but he did not return our calls. As the civil war enters its second year in Sudan, two warring factions remain locked in a deadly power struggle. Nearly 2 million displaced Sudanese have fled to unstable areas in Chad, Ethiopia, and South Sudan, overrunning refugee camps. Yehes Wihub spoke with Michael Wold Old Mariam, an associate professor in the School of Public Policy at the University of Maryland and a senior fellow at the Center for International and Security Studies. Michael calls Sudan's situation catastrophic.
The situation is catastrophic for the region's, for the country's people. There is, of course, you know, the mass displacement, right? Millions is the biggest displacement crisis in the world, deplorable humanitarian conditions, and a real risk of famine, and of course, just the terrible violence being perpetrated against civilians. It is a troubling situation, needs to trouble the region. And I think an added layer here is, you know, real risks of a broader regional metastasization of this conflict, right? That this conflict could spread, could further draw in neighboring countries and others.
So where is the situation in Sudan heading as we go forward? Will the warring factions in Sudan, will they ever come to a negotiating table to talk? To talk about stopping this pressing, tragic matter?
You know, I think, you know, where do I see the conflict going? I think, you know, the conflict is in a kind of stalemated phase. I mean, I think it's been in that condition for some time. And I think part of the issue is that, you know, both sides have been able to, you know, cultivate sources of external support to kind of stabilize their respective military positions and have on some level kind of checkmated one another. I mean, for a time, it seemed as if the RSF would continue to make military gains, further penetrate into eastern Sudan. But it seems as if the SAF has now, you know, has managed to rally and sort of stabilize its situation. And I think, again, you know, the ability of these various parties to bring in foreign backing has been a critical part of the stalemate that we've seen. So, I mean, I would.
Why does it seem there is no urgency from the international community, from the surrounding regions? There seems to be no effort being made to stop this madness.
I would expect this to continue for a period of time, but eventually, I think we're going to need to see a regional framework for addressing the Sudan crisis that brings in all of the various kind of regional interveners that are involved, to bring them together alongside with the parties, you know, perhaps with the involvement of key extra-regional actors like the United States, to have a conversation about a pause in fighting that then can lead to a more durable settlement and transition in Sudan. But I think the key thing here to emphasize is going to take regional approach, because this has become a regionalized civil war.
That's Michael Woldemariam, an associate professor in the School of Public Policy at the University of Maryland and a senior fellow at the Center for International and Security Studies. He spoke with my colleague Yehes Wihup. You are listening to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Coming up, President Biden's policy towards Africa. Find out more after the break.
Hello, listener of South Sudan in Focus. We have an exciting new segment dubbed Words of Wisdom. We want to hear your thoughtful proverbs that echo through your community. This is another chance for you to share wisdom from your roots. All you need to do is record a proverb in a language of your choice, tell us its English translation and what it means. Keep it brief, authentic, and represent your community. Your recorded proverb shall be sampled on South Sudan in Focus every Wednesday. Send your recording via our WhatsApp number, +1 202 630 8011. That is +1 202 630 8011.
You are listening to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Our words of wisdom for today comes from Terekeka, the capital city of smoked fish.
Hi, Voice of America. This is Kenny Wani David from South Sudan, Juba. I have a Mundari proverb. said. A kinjiri abodan dingi darojo e diniki inagajoguma kungurupi. It said, if a bird stay too long on the tree, it smite a stone.
You are listening to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. A ceasefire between Israel and the Lebanese military group Hezbollah appears to be holding its residents in cars heaped with belongings streamed back towards southern Lebanon. President Joe Biden on Tuesday welcomed a ceasefire deal between Israel and the Iran-backed militant group Hezbollah in Lebanon. However, there is no indication the deal will hasten a truce and hostage release deal in Gaza, where Israel is battling Palestinian militant group Hamas. White House bureau chief Patsy Widakwaswara has this report.
After days of Israeli strikes on the capital Beirut and other cities in Lebanon and rocket fire from Iran-backed militant group Hezbollah into Israel, a ceasefire between the warring parties lauded by U.S. President Joe Biden Tuesday.
Effective at 4 a.m. tomorrow local time, the fighting across the Lebanese-Israeli border will end. This is designed to be a permanent cessation of hostilities.
Biden spoke following a speech by Benjamin Netanyahu earlier on Tuesday. The Israeli prime minister agreed to a ceasefire after over a year of cross-border clashes initiated by Hezbollah over the war in Gaza, where Israel is battling Hamas, another Iran-backed group.
With the United States' full understanding, we maintain full freedom of military action. If Hezbollah violates the agreement and tries to arm itself, we will attack. If it tries to rebuild terrorist infrastructure near the border, we will attack.
Netanyahu said Israel needs to refocus attention on its operations in Gaza following Hamas' deadly terror attack on Israel last October and the threat posed by Iran. But there is no indication the truce in Lebanon will lead to a ceasefire in Gaza and the release of Israeli hostages held by Hamas.
Over the coming days, the United States will make another push with Turkey, Egypt, Qatar, Israel, and others to achieve a ceasefire in Gaza.
In an address to a United Nations forum Tuesday, Iran accused the Israeli government of war crimes and genocide and welcomed the recent arrest warrant for Israel's leader issued by the International Criminal Court over the war in Gaza. Foreign Minister Abbas Araghchi.
We are all obliged under international law to assist the Palestinian people in their lawful and legitimate struggle to secure their right for self-determination against occupation and apartheid.
Under the ceasefire, Israeli forces will retreat south of the Lebanon-Israel border, while Hezbollah will move north of the Litani River. The plan calls for the Lebanese army, which is not involved in the Israeli-Hezbollah fighting, to patrol the region between the two warring sides. The U.S. and France will help monitor ceasefire violations. Patsy Widakuswara, VOA News, Washington.
During the U.S.-Africa Leaders Summit in Washington 2 years ago, President Joe Biden promised to visit Africa in the coming year. He planned a trip there last month, but a hurricane in the U.S. forced the White House to postpone the visit. Now, Biden is preparing to make good on that promise with a two-day visit to Angola in early December, just weeks before he leaves office. Cameron Hudson, senior fellow with the African program at the Center for Strategic Studies, tells VOA's Carol Van Dam, although the trip is important, the Biden administration has not lived up to its own rhetoric about strengthening U.S. ties with the continent.
What I would say is that they kind of prioritized Africa from a rhetorical sense, but when it came to the follow-up and putting it into practice, they really didn't, make good on their promises, right? So the president promised, you know, a seat at the table for Africa when global decisions were being made. They didn't get that. They didn't get the reform of the international institutions like the UN Security Council or the World Bank that he also promised. You know, he obviously promised to travel to the continent, and he has delayed the trip, you know, multiple times since since he made that promise. So I think that what Africans feel is rather let down, you know, not because they had such high expectations of the United States. It's that Biden created high expectations for himself and his administration, which he failed to live up to.
When you say he created those expectations, you mean during the big U.S.-Africa summit here in 2022?
Well, even before that, you know, 2 weeks after his inauguration, he addressed the African Union summit, and he promised African leaders just 2 weeks into his administration that things were going to be different, that Africa was going to be a top priority for the United States, that he was going to go there, and that things would be different. So he promised that 2 weeks after he started. It took 2 years to have an African leaders summit in which he kind of doubled down on these promises, right? He said, I'm all in on Africa. That didn't materialize in the way that people expected it to.
What could he have done to make relations better and to beef up the relationship that the U.S. has with African nations?
Well, I mean, he could have spent more of his own time engaging African leaders. Let's remember that when some of the biggest decisions were made, like imposing sanctions on Russia after its invasion of Ukraine, or in decisions around COVID vaccines, Africans were not at the table when major international decisions that had huge consequences for the continent as a whole were being made. And that goes against the promise that he made. So he could have included those conversations among Africans. He could have gone to the G20 as opposed to the G7.
Why Angola?
Why Angola? Well, Angola has become the kind of darling of the United States right now. Angola is a strategic country. It sits on the Atlantic coast, so it's essentially a neighbor of the United States. It's a country that for its entire independent period has been very squarely in the kind of Russia-Chinese communist orbit. And Washington has been working mightily to move Angola out of this communist orbit and into an American orbit. So they want to keep a Chinese naval presence out of Angola. They're trying to displace Chinese investment. They're shining a light on what many U.S. officials call kind of improper lending practices to Angola by the Chinese. And of course, now with the Libido Corridor that he's going to inaugurate for maybe the fourth or fifth time, and he's cutting the ribbon on this thing, he has a rail line, so an investment in infrastructure, which he has often criticized China of, and yet he's now, you know, using the Chinese playbook. But it's a critical investment for the United States because it, you know, taps into those kind of critical mineral resources deeper inside of Africa that we know are of great strategic importance to the United States, and he's bringing them out to the Atlantic coast away from China.
That's Cameron Hudson, senior fellow with the Africa program at the Center for Strategic Studies. He was speaking with my colleague Carol Van Dam from Addis Ababa, Ethiopia. President Donald Trump made a largely unexpected pick to run the world's largest military, nominating Fox News television host and Army veteran Petty to be Defense Secretary. VOA Pentagon correspondent Carla Babs has more.
Pete Hegseth is a decorated Army National Guard veteran who served in Iraq, Afghanistan, and Guantanamo Bay. But the former weekend host of the TV show Fox and Friends has no previous experience in government or in running a large organization.
Retired Rear Admiral Mark Montgomery is with the Foundation for Defense of Democracies.
I think this is an extremely unusual pick. This is not a starter job. And, you know, you would expect someone coming in this job to have a significant amount of managerial experience.
Hegseth raised his profile by hinting at several changes to the Defense Department, opposing the Pentagon's diversity, equity, and inclusion programs, which he has called woke.
There is no black, white, or brown in our ranks. We're all green, and we all bleed red. Our strength is not in our diversity, but in our unity and in our love for our nation, our families, and most of all, each other.
Hegseth has also suggested removing women from combat positions.
I'm straight up just saying we should not have women in combat roles. It hasn't made us more effective, hasn't made us more lethal, has made fighting more complicated.
Marine Corps researchers compared all male and gender integrated combat units from 2014 to 2015. They found the all male units were faster and stronger, but the gender integrated groups had better problem solving skills. Morale remained the same. Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin had this message to the women now serving in combat positions after completing the same grueling task as men.
Well, I think our women add significant value to the United States military. We need you. We have faith in you. We are appreciative of your service. And you add value to the finest and most lethal fighting force on Earth.
Trump has praised his Harvard and Princeton educated pick as tough, smart, and a true believer in America. After Hegseth's nomination, reports surfaced of a sexual assault allegation from 2017. Hegseth paid the accuser at the time, he says, to avoid publicity. He also says the encounter was consensual.
The matter was fully investigated, and I was completely cleared, and that's probably.
A Senate majority must confirm Hegseth's nomination. While Republicans currently hold the majority by 3 seats, analysts say that doesn't guarantee confirmation, with a stance against women in combat that many in Congress see as outdated.
Retired Rear Admiral Mark Montgomery.
As I look at the senators, you know, you have Senator Joni Ernst there, herself a female combat veteran. I'm sure she'll have some interesting questions for him about his opinions on that. So from my perspective, that's going to be a very challenging issue.
President-elect Trump had rocky relationships with defense secretaries in his first administration. One of them, former Secretary of Defense Mark Esper, has called Trump unfit for office. Officials say Hegseth's loyalty to Trump is strong. Carla Babb, VOA News, The Pentagon.
That's all we prepared for you on this Wednesday, November 27, 2024. We now leave you with Vivian singing in her native Shuluk language, praising the Cholo King. Been listening to Vivian and the song Nyekan. The Cholo are found in Upper Nile State. For more on our programs, visit www.voaafrica.com. I'm your host, John Tanza, on this live broadcast from Studio 14 here in Washington. On behalf of our producer, Kwame Ofori, and engineer, Chang, we wish you a lovely evening. Remember to join us tomorrow for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Yeah.